Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by those lovely people at Cooker. 100-degree boiling hot water, straight from your kitchen tap. As regular listeners know, mine also does filtered water too. No buying bottled water for me, which is good for the environment. Also, the Cooker system uses a vacuum to keep the water hot, which is more energy efficient than constantly boiling a kettle. Cooker really is the future. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour, I'll be speaking to ex-Marine and adventurer Ordo Kane about his adventures in the forces and his ventures since leaving. Actually, there's kind of too many to list here. I mean, his book is insane how much he's done. He's been all over the world, all over the planet, setting up and appearing in adventure TV shows with the likes of Steve Backshaw, Jason Box, Guy Martin, Ed Stafford, all your action heroes there. He's also risked his life by investigating drug cartels and poachers. Oh, yeah, and he also decided to spend 50 days rowing the Atlantic the hard way. This is a real-life action hero. The Times called him the thinking man's action hero. Let's meet him. Here's Ordo Kane. Ordo, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for giving me some time, because you don't have much time, do you? You're always out and about around the world. Where have you been recently?
Good morning or good afternoon. Good. I just got back from up in the north, up in the Arctic. So I was up Svalbard and then further north up into the ice edge up at 82 degrees. So we were filming. So I just got back on Saturday. Handed my 6-month-old boy, and now it's daddy daycare time.
What were you filming? Are you allowed to tell me?
A project called Ocean Explorers, and it's James Cameron, BBC Studios, the Blue Planet team, making it for Nat Geo. So it's basically exploring the world's oceans on this state-of-the-art research vessel. We've got two submarines on board, helicopter, ROVs, all this mapping stuff. So essentially we go to an area and then we hit it with all the scientific instruments and toys that we've got. It's due to come out 2023, early 2023. So that was the last, we did 3 2-month trips and that was the last one.
So what are the problems you're encountering there? Is it cold?
Yeah, I mean, on the last one, so we did Bahamas, Dominican Republic, Azores, and then the Arctic. We're diving under ice, for example, which is cold. All the work that we were doing up there, cold was the big sort of thing that we were having to look out for. But we're, you know, as exploration goes, the ice edge has retreated so much in the last few years alone, just with the change in temperature and climate change, that where we were with the vessel and where we were mapping and exploring was had never been done before. In a sad way, it was cutting edge exploration because the ice has always been there that time of year.
You're an expert. You've done everything, haven't you? Heights, depths, water, everywhere, cold, hot. Do you have to phone around sometimes your mates and go, like Jason Fox, who I'll talk about later, but you talk about a lot. Do you have to sometimes phone him around and say, mate, I'm doing this thing, you know, have you got any expertise on this? Or do you pretty much know it all now, do you think?
I think that's probably the dangerous part, because the ego will get you if you think you know it all. That's when you get your ass handed to you, especially in sort of extreme or remote or hostile locations. I would say I'm a jack of all trades. I'm good at managing people in austere conditions, but I certainly don't have the uber skill level. If we're away with Steve Backshaw, for example, and we're doing a big wall climb, then we'll use some of the best climbers in the world, and I'm kind of being dragged along on that. Or if we're doing big diving job or the one that we've just been doing there, Ocean Explorers, I'm jack of all trades. I learn from everyone. One week I'm working with NASA scientists, and the next week I'm working with Foxy. The next week I'm working with geologists, volcanologists, or celebrities. So It's kind of a mixed bag, and I wouldn't say I'm an expert in all of that stuff, but I am, you know, I have over the years of 25 years of working in extreme locations, managed to build quite a good skill set.
What did you learn going to the bottom of the ocean? Have you learned? I mean, I suppose you didn't make it to the bottom of the ocean, did you? But what did you learn?
I went down to, actually on the last trip, I went down in one of their submersibles down to 1,000 meters.
Wow.
So 3,000 feet. I, you know, first of all, I was shitting myself. Because you're not, and I'm not in control. It's a tiny sphere, three people in it. Buck, friend of mine, was driving it. And as the, you know, as it lets out the gas and you start to sink below the surface, you realize that, you know, you're in this acrylic ball, and the pressure at 1,000 meters is just epic. You know, it would crush you. And then you just drift down to, it was the seabed where we were at, was 1,000 meters, and it's just utterly stunning. And I think the one thing that I learned from that is that we're, you know, when you're down there is more life that you can see down there, microscopic life, when you do the flashback of the lights and the sub. And it kind of puts life into perspective. You know, you come back to the hustle and bustle of everyday life after having been down to the bottom of the sea. You know, it's just like a fairly special place. And you kind of makes you think about, we're leaving the planet to go and explore the moon, to explore Europa, to explore Mars. And yet we haven't even explored our own ocean before it's being destroyed, essentially.
That's probably a good thing, because we probably find something down there we want and then ruin it by taking it out of there or whatever. I want to get into your book in a minute, but the astronauts have a thing called the overview effect when they go up into the I've said this so many times this podcast, but I've interviewed a few astronauts. They always think they're going to look out at all the other planets. Actually, they don't. They just look at back at Earth and go, hey, why aren't we looking after that thing, because it looks so beautiful with its blues and greens. Do you have an overview effect when you go down under in the ocean? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think you get that sense of, you know, the planet is covered in over 70% of ocean, and you know, to, you know, that this sub only goes to 1,000 meters. The deepest places are 5,000-6,000 meters, you know, so if not more. And so you feel like you've just scratched the surface of it. But it gives you, maybe it's the opposite effect of that, where you're so focused on the blue dot of you know, at depth in front of you and the microscopic organisms there, it kind of puts everything into perspective, I guess.
Yeah. Right, your book, I love it. I actually couldn't put it down. I've just read it. Really, it's such an easy read, because you start and you go, I just can't stop reading this because there's so much. It made me feel shit though, because you know, you've had so many adventures, and you know, going away to West Brom when I was a kid is not quite the same as the stuff you've got up to. Tell us, I'll do a really quick summary for anyone who doesn't know you. You're in the army, then you left the forces, you came out and you were doing some crap jobs. You managed to find yourself getting into TV, and since then it's just been a sort of avalanche of amazing adventures all around the planet. So you had some in the army, then it was a bit boring, and then it's like boof. I mean the stuff you've done is absolutely incredible, isn't it? Why did you write the book?
So the book Lessons from the Edge was really a collection of my life up until this point, you know, from joining the Royal Marines at 16, you know, becoming a commando at that age, and then everything else that follows it. But it was much more for me about writing a book that could help others. So like, almost, it's not self-help, it's more like adventure help. You know, it's like the stuff that I've learned in extreme environments is equally applicable to the daily grind, you know, to the daily drive. You know, everyone's dealing with anxiety and fear, and especially now, you know, we live in crazy times. And you know, it was really just to sort of get all of that stuff down, first of all for me, you know, on paper, and then to then think, well, hopefully I can help other people. And you know, you say I've had a pretty mental life, but it feels to me normal joining the Marines.
You want to read it? Oh, no, give it a read because it is mental. The stuff you've done is insane. I mean, out of all the people I've interviewed, you've done more than anyone else. And by the way, when I say it makes me feel shit, only makes me feel shit is the fact that, you know, I've had a pretty good life, don't get me wrong. But, you know, you've just done so many bloody adventures. And as a, you know, as a human, I just think you've explored the planet so much. Actually, one thing I will say right at the beginning here is I tried recently to book a holiday to Antarctica because I thought, where can I go? Like, I can't go to space. Where can I go where no one else has been? Right? I mean, 0.000 something of human species have probably been to Antarctica.
Yeah.
But I was looking at prices of $30,000 to $70,000 and I was like, oh, well, I can't afford that. That's bollocks. You know, I can't do that. But you do all this stuff and get paid for it. But you've been to places like with Steve Backshaw and you're just saying their own thing. You've been to so much of this planet where nobody else has ever been.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that is, you know, it's a privilege to do that and a privilege to travel, right? You know, especially now, you know, when lockdown smashed us in the face. I was in South Sudan working and we were over there on a BBC documentary for 3 weeks, came back into lockdown, and that's when I then decided about writing the book because it was a good time, right? If you can't do it at any time, you know, if that's the only time that you're going to have off, then that's a good time to write it. And when I started jotting everything down that I'd done, you know, in the last year, I'd done 13 or 14 world firsts, you know, whether it's paddling, sea kayaking in, you know, up in the Arctic, or whether it was cave diving and exploring caves in Mexico. And I guess I just got to that point of thinking, this is, you know, I'm utterly privileged to have been to these places. But what did it more for me, Steve and I did a series a couple of years ago, and actually when we were getting to places that we thought no one had ever been before, and then there's signs of people having passed there in the Amazon or in Suriname, for example, that have been passing that same spot for thousands of years, sharpening the axe. You know, it's the first time that we've paddled down that river, and yes, it's the first time the river's been explored, but there's always been people there. And that's what I loved, actually, being you know, reminded that, you know, we're not the first people really to do lots of these things. We're maybe the first people to document it, but people have been traveling the earth for hundreds of thousands of years. I feel privileged to have done a lot of that traveling. That Antarctica trip, you should just be doing, going in a sub somewhere. I'm sure there's somewhere you can jump in a sub and go down to 1,000 meters.
Well, I just thought Antarctica would be a good place to go because as I understand, it's the biggest desert. No one goes there. And I contacted someone and said, do you need any help, any volunteers? And they're like, nope. So basically, there's only two ways of doing it, which is on a cruise. And I can't think of anything worse and more, you know, like, oh, let's go on a real adventure. And I'm going to sit on a cruise with a load of, you know, people who are not most adventurous. Or you have to pay for a lot of money to go to Peru and then fly in and sleep there for a week. But it's a lot of money because I suppose it's hard to get to. And this is the thing about the stuff you do. It's quite hard to get to. You're self-sufficient and doing that though, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a long way away, you know, to get, you know, to Antarctica. I've never been. It's on the list, but, you know, I'm the same as you.
Oh, I want to beat you to it.
We should go together. Let's get Foxy together and we're going to do a ski down there.
Yeah, can't we do it? Let's do it. Let's try and get a TV show commissioned. The great thing, by the way, about I talked to Steve Batchelor a lot on my TV shows, and the great thing to talk about that little adventure you had where you were going through the Amazon and all that sort of stuff was because it feels so wonderful. It's got to be a downside. And so I sort of said to him one day, what about like the insects? He went, oh yeah, you get eaten alive. And it was, there is so much life in the Amazon, isn't there? And he said, oh, we got absolutely like bitten to hell by insects and stuff. Is that true?
Yeah. The first trip I did with Steve was in Venezuela. This is all in the book as well. But, you know, the first trip I did with Steve, you know, we go and we're climbing this Tipuy, these tabletop mountains in Venezuela. And Steve's doing this bit to camera. He's just seen for the first time, I believe, and filmed I think it's called the tarantula hawk wasp. And what it does is it stings a tarantula and it immobilizes it. And then it drags it off into a burrow and then it lays its eggs inside it. And the eggs of the larvae then eat around all the vital organs of the spider, so it stays alive while it's being eaten to death. And anyway, Steve's doing this bit to camera. Cameras are following Steve. He's doing this. He gets stung by the wasp. And then just so I'm behind camera laughing at him as he gets stung. And as I put my shirt on, there's a bullet ant inside my shirt, and it stings me three times on my left tip, basically. And I'm telling you, it's like you're being shot. That's why it's called the bullet ant. But yeah, the jungles are by far, actually the biggest risk in jungles is deadfall, is falling trees that have been smashed by lightning, full of water, and then drop down on your position. But the insects do get to you. You know, there's just no getting it. It's like being in Scotland in the summer with the midges.
I think the two things which could hurt you most probably are, is malaria, isn't it? It's the biggest killer of human beings, I suppose, yeah, in the history of human beings after old age, and other humans. And I suppose when you're out there and you get yourself put in these sort of remote places, or you're a million miles away from things, if you've got something that's attractive to somebody and they've got a gun or a weapon and you don't, then you know, you're putting yourself at risk, I suppose. We'll talk about that later, because you've done a lot of stuff with poachers and yeah, narcos, which we'll discuss, because that's quiet. But what happens with malaria? Are you worried about that at all?
It's weird, because the whole pandemic has brought around a lot of questions and about how people travel and where they travel and where this has come from. I worked on a film a few years ago about Ebola in West Africa. So I was in.
By the way, that chapter is absolutely insane, and it's insane that you went and did that. Well done to you, because yeah, I know you prepare well, but there must have been times that you went right in there amongst Ebola. I mean, there must have been times you were thinking, what am I doing?
That's, I mean, I thought I had Ebola. I thought I'd contracted the virus at one point. I'd, you know, we'd been filming inside the Ebola treatment centers, and just by the way, these guys that were, you know, these doctors and healthcare workers that were working across West Africa at the time were risking their lives to, you know, to protect these, you know, in Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone. And I was privileged enough to go and be a fly on the wall and follow these guys around as they were doing their daily business. And I tell you, I've never been so utterly moved by something in my life through the deaths were phenomenal. The amazing stories of people surviving the virus, the sadness of, you know, the corruption that was happening, that was prolonging things. And that's one of, you know, when I went down there, I thought, you know, if something like this ever happened in the rest of the world or in the UK, we'd probably nail it and wipe it out pretty quickly. And like I said in the book, you know, it definitely was the exact same here as it was over there. And a lot of it's scaremongering, fear, and it affects travel, it affects jobs, lives, people. But yeah, when I was there, I'd been working inside the Ebola treatment centers. And so we're, you know, there's maybe 10, 15 people dying of Ebola, and the doctors are going in full, in the heat of the day, going in full PPE to look after their patients. And so I'd been in two or three times to different centers, and like you do now, you get your temperature taken by the, you know, at the airport. I had my temperature taken at the hotel and another two places, and it was high. So I had a fever, and I ended up sort of, I quarantined myself in the hotel. This is 2014. So a lot of the terminology that we're using now about socially distanced, washing your hands, all this stuff was commonplace, you know, down
and
there.
What was it? What was the temperature in the end?
I was up. Probably. I was up at 38 something, hot for me, and even hot for being out there at the time. And a long story cut short, I thought I had Ebola. It was perfectly obvious of the work that I'd been doing that I probably did have. And a long story cut short, over the period of 2 days quarantining and some testing, I had food poisoning, which, you know, that's a long couple of days when you're sort of, when I've been there for 6 weeks already watching people contract the virus, go into care and then die from it. And so it was, yeah, it was pretty full on scary time. But yeah, that I suppose being able to see these different, you know, across the board, like you say, I'm doing some expeditions, but you know, the stuff that I've been doing with people and understanding and learning about different people in different places and cultures has been brilliant. Really enjoyed it.
So I suppose it'd be really frustrating, wouldn't it, if you've been inside volcanoes, you've taken on drug cartels, I'm not taking them on, but investigated the poachers, you know, you've been in Ebola. It would be bad, wouldn't it? All the stuff you've done, if you got basically killed by a mosquito
that's getting round to what you asked in the first place. I'd go off on a tangent, but yeah, you know, I have been vaccinated for all of these things. When you travel, yellow fever, you can't get into Africa without having your, you know, yellow fever certificate. And then malaria, you know, there was one point 2 years ago where I was on malaria pills for the entire, you know, it was like 3 or 4 months back to back. But I've never, in all the places I've been, the only thing that I've ever had really was thinking that I had Ebola. The rest of it, you know, I've been lucky enough not to have malaria, not to have dengue, or any other fevers that go around.
Interestingly, you know, if I'm taking lessons from your book, I would say it's take opportunities is what you seem to have done in your life, is see opportunities and go, right, I'm taking those. Then I think it's prepare. What you seem to lay out in your book is you're always prepared. And I think that's what the military taught you. And the other thing is don't take silly risks. And that seems to be the, you know, be smart with it. So go and have as much fun as you can and take the opportunities out in the world, but always make sure you're fully prepared before you do it. Apart from when you rode the Atlantic, would you agree with that?
Look, my job is to, you know, when I'm working in television, you know, behind the scenes, behind the camera, I look after people in extreme remote and hostile locations. We try to reduce the risk or reduce the likelihood of these hazards happening. So we can go to a volcano, it's active, it's, it's dangerous, but we can mitigate against lots of things. And then you have the objective danger that you might get hit on the head by a lava bomb, right? That's, you can't change that. So my job is to identify all the hazards and mitigate them. But what amazes me is that, you know, I'm much more of a control freak. I'm not a risk taker. I try and reduce the amount of risk and hazards so much so. And you'll notice the same with like Foxy. We leave very little to chance because the chance of something happening that has a catastrophic outcome is, you know, that's the danger. But what amazes me more is the risks that people take in real everyday life of jumping in the car and not putting a seatbelt on. Like, to me, I can't compute that because I want to travel the world and do all this adventurous things, but I don't want to be wiped out in a car accident. I don't want to be wiped out, you know, doing something utterly pedestrian and mundane. So it's weird. You end up in this juxtaposition where you're in these incredibly high octane, dangerous, full on situations, but you're so dialed that you've tried to minimize as much of the risk and hazard as you can. Sometimes though,
yeah,
shit's just dangerous.
Do you know what? It's funny because you talk about Jason Fox. We might as well get onto him. I've interviewed him a couple of times. Love him. I love his book and always enjoy talking to him. Honest fella. You seem like you're very good friends. You decided to to row across the Atlantic the hard way, 50 days worth of rowing. I love this chapter in the book. It makes me laugh so much because you turn up without any prep or any training, and then one of you forgets to put the tea and coffee in into the boat, and then you're like, you just row, and you're such adventurous, strong men. You just get there. I mean, I can't believe you did it.
Well, I just got back, so we rowed from Lagos in Portugal to Venezuela. You know, it's the first time that any team has rowed across the Atlantic from mainland Europe to mainland South America. But I had been away with Steve Baxter on that trip in Venezuela, and I had flown back almost the exact same route that in a few months' time we were going to be rowing, and it took me 10 hours, four bottles of wine, you know, yeah, a couple of movies. And I remember sort of coming back and joining the team. So there's Foxy, obviously, Ross Johnson, Matt Bennett and Ollie Bailey. And they had this meeting when I was away in Venezuela. I'd been on expedition for 6 weeks, and it was kind of like they were going to kick me off the team. And I was like, you can't do that. My job isn't 9 to 5. And they were like, you got to pull your weight. So I was like, shit, okay. So we went and did this. Pulling my weight was this one row that we did out of Burnham on sea. And we sort of rowed out for an hour, moored up against the buoy and had a load of beer and food on the boat, and then rowed back in. That was it. And then like a month later, we set out across the Atlantic. And, you know, it was actually one of the most amazing adventures that I've been on, because it was with four mates. I was sharing the cabin with Foxy, which is, you know, pretty tough at the best of times, because he is massive. And those cabins are tiny, tiny, small. But yeah, we sort of like night before I went out and had dinner and a few beers, and we're all still like lads, big timing it. And then we get on the boat the next day, a bit hungover, set off, start rowing out. And then night came and it was like, shit, that's it. That's us. That's the last time we see land. And it was the last time we saw land for like nearly 49 days or something like that. And you're sat in your seat like, yeah, an hour ago, roaring the gym, and you're 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
And it's worth getting the book just for that chapter, because the way you write it is fantastic. All you lot, the adventures you have on that boat. And also, I think you do it really well, because it just seems like so boring just getting in every few hours and just rowing. And then there's obviously the storms and everything. I mean, it's a real adventure, that, isn't it?
I mean, it's the classic sort of definition of adventure, with a journey, yeah, with an unknown outcome.
Yeah, with also must have been pure exhaustion, which you point out, and the amount of sores and blisters and everything else. The fact that you had to clean out Jason Fox's bum because it got infected, which must have been horrific for you. So
yeah, being that close, like I say, the cabins are tiny, and being like 6 inches away from his back doors and having to lance it and squeeze the pus out of his.
You know, although I know you speak a lot about Forces hero, should we call him, Jason Fox, in your book, and I know you're good mates with him, and so I messaged him and asked him for a question for you today. So SAS Who's Dares wins, Jason Fox said, ask him why he got one of the lads to carry a single seat Chesterfield to the top of a mountain in the Scottish Highlands for what appeared to be absolutely no reason. Bellend.
Cheers, Foxy. Although it's my wedding anniversary today, but that was from 2 years ago. When we got married, I said to my mate James Woodruff, can you carry a chair up, because we got married up on the side of a mountain, can you carry a chair up so that my grandma can have a seat when she comes up for the wedding? And he's like, yeah, fine. So he, sweaty his tits off, carries this chair up to the top of this hill, like an hour. And Foxy and I carry my grandma up there all the way to the top of the hill, and she's like, why have you got this seat here? And I was like, it's for you, Grandma. James has brought it all the way up here. And she was like, I don't need a seat. We don't need a seat up here. That's fine. I'll stand. So he carried it the whole way up there, and she didn't use it.
I know James, by the way. I used to work with him years ago. What a lovely bloke. Good producer.
Yeah, he is amazing. So James Woodruff and Foxy were my sort of master of ceremonies and best man at the wedding. So I had, they're great guys. I got a lot of shit for that.
That's good. Say hello to him for me next time.
I will do. I will do.
I've not spoken to him for quite a long time. I'll tell you what we're going to do here, if that's all right. Let's take a little break for an advert, and we'll come back and we'll discuss. We'll discuss how you've seen the worst of humanity with drug trafficking, drug dealing, and obviously poaching and all that stuff with the tigers, which is horrible. Let's just take a quick break. Welcome back. I'm joined by Aldo Kane, who's a real life action hero. Let's call him that. What is it that makes people like you Steve Backshaw, Guy Martin, you know, Ed Stafford, Jason Fox. You can list them all off. Great people. Why? What makes you lot want to go out there and have these adventures?
I don't know whether it's where we're brought up or something like that. But for me, you know, that sense of adventure that I have now is why I joined the Scouts when I was, you know, young boy, and then why I joined the Marines at the age of 16. So it's just like I've been driven by, it's not about exploration of places per se, but more when I'm older now, I kind of realize it's more about exploring how I am in those situations and in those environments. And I think for me, it's always been about a physical challenge and a mental challenge and understanding where my breaking points are and what I'm good at and what I'm bad at. And I often find that being on expedition or being at war, for example, any of these things, the bonds and the skills that are created in them are second to none. And eventually, you know, they sort of work in all the way through your life for the rest of your life. So I think the call to adventure almost has just been something that, you know, that I've had. And I think everyone has it when they're young. We you know, we're all adventurous in our heads. We all have these dreams about all the things that we want to do and can achieve. And then we kind of get bashed down by life in a way. You get to a point where, you know, your sort of trappings of your life, the things you own, end up owning you, and it becomes hard to get away or to truly follow like that thing that you your passion.
Yeah, I did an interview with a woman. You must have come across her, Megan Hine, who does.
Yes,
a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
She's great. She wrote this fantastic book, Mind of a Survivor. Yeah, it's a really good book, and it really made me. I interviewed her on this, and it really made me think. She was worried that she was having to take kids out sometimes. They did have motor neuron skills, and she said it was really worrying that we're protecting our children so much that they're losing the ability to actually go and have an adventure.
Yeah.
It's an interesting interview if anyone wants to listen back to that. But it is worrying that we are making ourselves so safe. Let me just carry on with this really quickly because I had this interview on a podcast the other day with talking about diet, and I said two things. One thing, that I don't enjoy every meal because I want to appreciate food, and I want to make sure that people think I'm nuts, but I want to make myself understand that I'm eating calories to survive as well as calories to enjoy myself. I don't want to use food too much for entertainment, even though I do love a lovely meal.
Yeah.
But the other thing I do is I do things like cold shower often every day, and because I don't like it, but it just makes me feel alive. And I also exercise, and sometimes I don't want to exercise, but I've got that David Goggins thing brainwashed into me that I have to do it. The best time to do it is when you don't want to do it, because that's the bit which makes you feel alive because you've actually achieved it. Do you think that's how you feel going out and doing all these adventures? I mean, there's times in your book you go, oh, I was thinking, should I do this? Yep, I'll do it. It's like, does it make you feel alive?
I think that's the key, right? Is that the turning point for me, really, I mentioned in the book, you know, the Confucius quote about you have two lives, and the second one starts when you realize you have only one. And I guess going to war, going to Iraq, for me personally was a big turning point where I realized that, you know, really you only have this one chance, and really everything that you want to have, you just really need to know what that thing is and then set out your goal list and then work towards it. And that to me has been key. And for me, saying yes to things is much more about experience. I like, you know, if you buy a car, that becomes just junk within a year, 2, 5 years. It doesn't become part of you. Whereas if you pay money to go on an expedition somewhere, that money then and that trip becomes part of your DNA. That's like hardwired. The more of those you do, the more of that person you become, and that shapes your life. And I think I sort of realized that fairly early on, you know, some of these lessons that we talk about in the book, I sort of realized early on and realized it, that it was about shaping your life, the one only chance that you've got on earth. And I found that utterly motivating, whereas I know some people probably find it demotivating to think that, you know, you only have this one life and then that's it. And what's the point? But for me, it was like, well, shit, you know, this is it. These are all the things that I've got to do and that I need to fit into this time.
It's funny you should say that. I've got a death chart. I'm just going to turn my email off there because it keeps binging away. Apologies for that. I've got this death chart on my fridge, which everyone laughs at. And it's got a red dot for every month that I've been alive. And then it's got a arrow to life expectancy when I was born. And it's got an arrow to life expectancy I've got now. And I look at all those dots and I think, I've not got enough dots left to do stuff I don't want to do. So yeah. I think it's inspiring. And everyone else goes, it's so morbid, Tim. It goes, no, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that I'm just going to go and sit in a pub and get drunk for no reason. It's like, I want a reason for doing.
Exactly. I think it's exactly that. I try to do it as a discipline of thinking about death, even if it's fleeting, you know, once a day, because that gives you that perspective on everything. Like, is this really, is this really important what I'm doing, or, you know, this thing that I'm pissed off about? And it's like you said about the astronauts, it just gives you that perspective. Is this really necessary? Is this essential? And, you know, and thinking about that, you then think, well, actually, you know, it's not morbid, but, you know, maybe I've only got 30 Christmases left. Maybe I've got 25, maybe I've got 15, who knows? Maybe I've only got 20 summer holidays left. Or, that is then what motivates me to then get up in the morning, do my fizz, get in the gym, do the exercise, speak to the people I need to speak to. I think it's a discipline. It's like you say, it's a discipline. You know, it's eating the calories because you need the calories, not because you want to, and that tastes nice. It's like, you know, I don't really thoroughly enjoy exercise, but I train a lot because I know it's good for me and it's even better for my head. And that actually, when I was locked in the bunker as part of that BBC experiment, I was locked in the dark for 10 days, you know, no contact to the outside, no technology, no watches, no light, nothing. And when I came out of that, I kind of had this like epiphany of these three things that are free that really make you a happier, better person. And it's exercise, daylight, and speaking to people. Like, that's free. You can do all three of those in one thing. Because at the end of the 10 days, I was starting to get quite down and I was thinking, you know, in normal everyday life, if you're not meeting people, you're not getting out and you're not exercising, you're kind of not giving yourself that good base layer.
Yeah, that's a great, when I was reading that chapter, it's another great chapter. You seem to trap yourself in these situations. And I think your life is like wearing a tight shoe. And then every now and then you get to take it off and go, oh, I'm home. And then you put yourself in another tight shoe. And then you put yourself in that situation. And I wonder, when you put yourself in these situations, you realize that we've moved so far away from nature that we're making ourselves miserable. I think, you know, life's pretty basic, isn't it? Look up, you've got one body. You know, people spend ages looking after their car and not their body. Look after your body. That's the thing you've got to go around in. Make sure you're putting good food in it. Make sure you're close to nature, because that's where we are. But if we're just spending all our life sitting watching Netflix on our mobile phones, and by the way, I'm a victim of this too, and I hate myself for it because I'm addicted to my bloody phone and all that sort of stuff. But actually, if you get out and you and exercise and get your blood pumping, you feel alive again, don't you? And you really get that from your book, by the way. Really,
but that's, you know, the book should come with a warning, I hope, for people, that it's going to do something to you. It's going to put the fire in your belly and get you to get up and get outside and do something. But you know, we live in an exponential age now, where the things that are advancing in technology and lifestyle, we look at, for example, the metaverse, you know, in years to come, I'm just sort of learning about it now, but people will have as much of their life embedded inside the metaverse than they will out inside the normal world. And that is both exciting and terrifying at the same time. And you know, this exponential age means that things are happening faster now than they've ever happened in the history of human beings being alive. And are we adapting? Can we adapt that quickly? Who knows? But for me, you know, being locked in the bunker and having all of that taken away, the darkness was sort of descending, and I realized it was exercise, you know, getting outside and meeting people, but also it's like you need to be active in the outdoor. I think our lives are going into that technical world, but we need to just take that time out to get outside and experience it.
The good thing, I suppose, about technology now, though, is they get to hear podcasts like this, which is great. Long form. We try and keep these an hour, so I'm going to move it on a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You discussed there going to war. You were a sniper. I suppose you see a different way. You visualize or you experience life slightly different to us because you've been in a scenario where you've killed. I mean, I say that because you've written which is quite a powerful chapter, actually. One bullet, two lives change. Two lives change, create your life plan. But you also see death. I imagine you saw death on our side, the other side. So you see how fragile life actually is. It takes one bullet.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, that's, like I said earlier, you know, Iraq was probably quite a big turning point for me. Weird in a way because, you know, I didn't go to Afghanistan after that, and you know, my time at war, for example, was very short-lived and very concise compared to the sort of drawn-out stuff that my mates, like Foxy, however many tours of Afghanistan. But, you know, I sort of came back from there, and I've just always been a thinking person, and I kind of was like, what is it? And I was also brought up, not religious, but I sort of, you know, hedged my bets, you know, with regards to God. And then I just remember over there having this enlightenment about, like, what the hell is this all about? What is life all about? What, you know, why does, you know, religion, does that mean that I can put a bit of lead in someone else? And then coming back with that and dealing with it and actually, you know, what did we do over there? I'm not entirely sure what we did do over there, but I suppose I came back and I was just so confused by it all, and it just made me start to ask these questions about life and about the fragility of it.
How do you square that off with yourself? Do you have problems thinking about it, the power you have to change the course of, as you say, two lives with one bullet? Is that it's a tough thing to really do as a human, isn't it?
It is, and it's, you know, I suppose I joined the Marines at the age of 16, and you know, it's weird because in my head I joined for adventure and travel, but, you know, at a very young age, you're shooting at targets, which are, you know, all military shoot at targets, but you're shooting at targets that, you know, could be a human one day. And, you know, as a sniper, you're much more far removed from it. You're not kicking doors down. You're not involved in the dirty sort of fighting. It's much more clinical and sort of abstract, as it were. So it kind of, to me, feels like a much easier way of compartmentalizing. And I'm not entirely sure that's a good way or a bad way, but, you know, I deal with that now and, you know, in my jobs, if I'm inside a volcano that's erupting and I'm utterly terrified, I have this ability to compartmentalize and sort of deal with facts, control the controllables, you know, just being able to control that situation, even though when everything else around you is chaos. And I think that's probably how I've managed to sort of come to terms with it, adjust, you know, and I always, weirdly, I always feel like a bit of a sort of fraud with the military stuff because I didn't do multiple tours in Afghanistan. And ultimately, really, it just comes down to, you know, I did 7 months over there and I came back and I thought, you know, the way that it affected me meant that I felt like there was too much more to be doing in life. If it was that fragile, there was too much more to be doing that I didn't want to be doing, you know, risking unnecessarily for something that wasn't, you know, wasn't true and a core belief of mine.
Can I just say to the listener here, it's really worth getting the book just to read about that because you do start. And also, I really recommend Jason Fox's book. Can't think what it is off the top of my head, but you look it up because his book is again, it's really lovely to hear what war's like from the actual perspective of someone who's there rather than our politicians and everybody else who's spouting about it on social media. It's because there are obviously emotions and everything attached to these things. And it's a real interesting insight, especially as we've just finished after 20 years and we've come out of that. Just quickly finishing on Sniper, well, the one bit I liked was you were talking about it where you say I might have got this slightly wrong, but the Americans liked their making sure they had their own weapon and the accuracy, whereas the bit of sniping you liked was, or the bit that you thought was most precious, was actually getting somewhere not seen. And it's the act of a sniper is actually not being seen, and that's the bit that you found thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, the Royal Marines sniper course is one of the best courses in the world for teaching that discipline. And actually, you know, the pulling the trigger part of being a sniper is the tiniest part of it. It's like the most furthest down the line part of it that generally, you know, in the training, you're trained at a very high level. But actually, the job that you're more there to do is to be eyes and ears. You know, for people, you're a protection force. You know, two people out front here can protect 100 people here. So really, they're called a force multiplier because they do exactly that. You know, two people, two well-trained snipers is the same as having maybe 100 men there. And so, but again, all of that comes down to things like ego killing. You know, you in the Royal Marines, you learn to be humble. The commando spirit, courage, determination, unselfishness, cheerfulness in the face of adversity, all of these things make you, you know, that humble person and be able to sort of compartmentalize that as a job, I think.
What's the longest distance you can shoot accurately?
Me now, I wouldn't hit a barn door.
You train. What is it?
We train out to 1,000 meters, so a kilometer. So if you were to walk that, you know, it'd probably take you 15, 20 minutes to walk the same distance. So it's like a long way.
Let's talk about, you've seen the worst of humanity. I love that line in your book because it's so true. The stuff you talk about with the poachers, the hunting, the traffickers who are trafficking body parts and tigers and things, and also the drug traffickers as well, the narcos, the drug cartels. I suppose what I was reading from it though was these, you know, when you're at war, it's because Tony Blair or Bush or someone's told you to go there. You're nothing to do with it. And I've always said that the person who kills the elephant doesn't dislike the elephant. They're doing it because they want money. And I think this is what you get across in your book a bit. It's like, there's someone at the end of the line who's buying the sodding product. And what scared the shit out of me was, well, not scared, but annoyed the shit out of me. In the case of the tigers, it's tiger glue, which people shave and put in a drink at high-end parties. I mean, they're the ones we need to go and kill. I mean, you know, put in prison or something. I'm getting a bit radical there on the death penalty for doing it. But then all the way down the line, you've got, it then ends up being this horror show. And likewise, I do a lot of geography reform on this. The person who's, if you're snorting coke at a weekend, I think it should be drug reform, by the way. But that, the people who are killing people and abusing people, it's because you're doing it at this end. You know, that's what creates the hell at that end.
I've done the Narcos series with Foxy, the Inside the Drug Lords, and then the tiger poaching film. And Foxy and I've done a lot of work with charities down in South Africa, teaching sort of anti-poaching drills and soldiering skills to teams down there. And you know, the one thing that if I post on social media we're doing anti-poaching stuff, the first thing people will say is shoot the bastards, kill the bastards. And you know, I have to admit, when I first left the Marines, I kind of thought the same myself. And the more I've gotten older and the more I've worked in these situations, the more I realize is that it's, you know, does someone really want to run with two other mates from Mozambique over 100 miles in one night with one rifle with three rounds to shoot a rhino, to chop its horn off and bring it back and get it into the trade, risking being shot by by the anti-poaching teams, being ripped apart by lions or anything, you know, smashed to bits by other animals out in the wild. Do the drugs guys in South America that Foxy and I were dealing with, you know, they're, you know, married, kids, living in the worst barrios or the states in Colombia, Peru, Mexico, where the government has utterly failed them. And the more that I started dealing with these people is they have zero choice. You know, it's easy for us to sit in our ivory towers here and say, you know, kill poachers. But that guy is, you know, he's just doing what he needs to do to survive. And you know, human security above all else is kind of, you know, what we should be aiming for. And then everything else in line and process. And you know, the more that Foxy and I dealt with those guys, the narcos and, you know, the poaching guys, is like, what we need to be doing is the traffickers, because it's the traffickers that are the businessmen, the market people. So first of all, it's education at the far end. It's saying to people in China, you don't need to drink tiger bone wine, and people in Vietnam, you don't need to shave tiger bone glue into your drinks, or eat pangolin scales, or you know, whatever these things are. That's education. But then the second thing is that the people in the middle, the traffickers, are the businessmen. They will just find another way of, you know, once the tigers are gone, they'll find another cat, let's say it's a civet cat, and they will now say that the whiskers are a luxury product, and then they sell and market that as you do any other product on earth. And it's those guys, the traffickers, that's why the Tigers film that I made was called Hunting the Traffickers, because it's those guys that need to be, you know, one of the guys that I found, I did an investigation into this tiger sanctuary and found three dead tiger cubs in the freezer. And that boss of the tiger farm was then found 3 weeks later with seven dead cubs in his car, selling them on in Hanoi. And, you know, that's they're the guys that need to go down for it. And you know, the guys at the bottom level are, you know, have rarely got any other choice. In fact, some of them would probably rather be dead than embroiled in landing 1,000 kilos of cocaine at the end of their jetty, you know, one night, knowing that they could get shot by the anti-narco cops, or you know, or another, you know, drug dealer who just want to takes the drugs off them. So yeah, it's kind of opened my eyes.
And mine too, when I was reading the book. But I think humans are very good at convincing themselves that they're not the bad guys, and it's, I'd like to talk to you about that guy Popeye who you discuss, who ends up being a hitman for a drug cartel, and he seemed to, I mean, you got yourself into some interesting scenarios, situations with Foxy on that. I mean, Christ, I think your heart must have been beating rapidly. But he seemed to thoroughly enjoy killing people, or saying he did, with his big ego. And I suppose there comes a time as a human you have to start, you can't be in the military, for instance, and go out there and think, oh, I can't kill anyone, because that's your job. You at some stage you have to convince yourself you're doing the right thing.
And it was interesting watching that Popeye. He's dead now, was an evil man, and you know, it didn't sit well with me or Foxy chatting to him, you know, for the film, for the program, because he's brought down a plane. He's shot, he said, over 2,000 people with his own pistol. You know, and like he has, you know, killed his wife. It's hard to reconcile that. And he was trying to reconcile that with Foxy. You know, we're up in his apartment block in Medellin. He's got a gun pointed at Foxy's head, and they're talking about how he would, you know, job someone, how he would kill someone as a sicario. And you know, obviously that is incredibly uncomfortable. Yeah. And he's like, you know, not many people have been on the end of my pistol and survived. And we're kind of like, well, this is odd. But they, you know, you know, like Foxy and him have this conversation where, you know, where he calls Foxy out and says, you're a murderer, I'm a murderer, you're just doing it for, you know, for the government. And it's, you know, in his viewpoint, in Popeye's viewpoint, this was, you know, this was perfectly acceptable. And, you know, and of course it isn't. But I guess it's being in these situations where you hear the other side of it, and it's very easy, you know, to point the finger and blame. But certainly with drugs, you know, there is, you know, that is slightly different to all the wildlife trafficking. You know, with drugs, it is very violent. And Foxy and I saw that in Mexico, where there's just utter chaotic brutality there. And, you know, it's kind of hard to justify that in any way. But if drugs weren't a problem, if people weren't snorting coke, you know, in a fight, it's hard. It's the same. I always associate it to kids going into a supermarket and seeing chicken wrapped in cellophane, you know, in a polythene sort of a wrapper, and not associating it with a chicken or a hen that's, yeah, you know, being killed. So there's a disconnect, and that disconnect is when you're hoovering cocaine in you know, London or wherever, that's come through the whole process of being farmed in the Vrain Valley in Peru. It's then gone through the whole trafficking to then get over into that place. There's been X amount of people killed per gram, blah, blah, whatever that is. So I think it's that there's the disconnect there with all of these things.
Which is why, I mean, look, we won't get into it now because I've done so much on it, but it's why I believe in drug reform. And if you want to listen to that, leave to listen to Steve Rolls, who is on last week's podcast, who tells you why, if drugs are legal or they're run by society rather than organized crime, you don't have that. And the farmers at the end of the who are growing the cocaine leaves, the coca leaves, they will be paid properly and they won't be treated like they are now. Because that's the thing, the farmers are treated appallingly as well, aren't they? In your
by everyone, I mean, they're from what Foxy and I saw, you know, they're I mean, by the narcos, they're at least treated slightly better than they are by the governments, because the narcos will take all of their coca leaf for a set price, which is higher than the government's. The government will come in and you know, they have to fit into it. It's almost like a sort of,
yeah,
you know, it's got to be a certain size and a certain, you know, quality of leaf. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that need to happen. It's certainly not a simple process, for sure.
When you travel around the world, though, when you're looking at the planet, let's take the humans away from it for a minute. Are you still in awe of it? I mean, do you still get a buzz every time you're standing? Like, when I go skiing, I'm standing on top of the Alps going, holy shit, look at this. This is amazing. I was out in Norway on Pulpit Rock the other day, and I was looking out going, wow, look at this planet. It's amazing. You still get that buzz?
Every time. It's like I'm utterly, you know, amazed by the planet. And, you know, I am lucky enough to have seen things that, you know, people probably haven't seen, you know, in places that people probably will never go. And I just had a moment on this last trip. I was working on a glacier. I was coming back down, and it's very hard to be in the Arctic and especially Svalbard, you know, and not think about climate change and how much we've, you know, we are exponentially trashing the planet at this point. And I kind of have this weight on my head, and it's kind of, I'm also part of the problem. And I get down and the ice is retreating quite far, and I find a bivalve fossil under the glacier, which is, you know, it's only retreated in the last year, for example. And that was once the bottom of the seabed, you know, it was a seabed, and now it's under a glacier. The glacier is retreating. And I was like, I was mind blown, thinking obviously this has been different before and it'll be different again. And then I spoke to the scientist I was working with, and he said, Aldo, what you have to remember is the CO2 levels have been much, much higher before. So that's fine, he said, but human beings won't exist and animals won't exist, but the planet will always be beautiful and it will always be here. And I was like, that's zero excuse to not pay attention to what, yeah, we're doing to the planet. But it was an interesting point of view, that it was just like humans will wipe themselves out and the planet will sort itself out.
Yeah, I always think it's weird that we're desperately trying to leave the planet. I think we should, by the way, be doing this. We should be exploring. That's what we are. That's sort of creatures we are. And we're trying to get to Mars or whatever. And yet we can't even get together to try and help our own planet and make sure this one survives. It just seems so crazy to me.
It's mind-boggling when you go to like Rwanda, you know, and the plastic bags are illegal. And it happened very quickly. You know, you can't travel into Rwanda with plastic bags in any of your kit, and I find that amazing. You know, COVID turns up and the government's got all these things that they can do overnight, bang, we do this. Can't sort out plastic bags, which is like one of the easiest things that we can sort out. I just, yeah, it just proves that everything is much more about politics and economy than it is anything else. That's for
yeah,
sure.
And it is. It's all power. I mean, trying to get this drug reform through, everybody who listens to the argument, every sensible person who listens to the argument goes, oh yeah, we should at least discuss it. Yeah, every single time you get a politician, whether it be Boris Johnson recently, he's got to keep an eye on Afghanistan now and the narcotics. It's like, oh, if you legalize the stuff, you take the problem away and then, you know, and control it, reform it. And not, you know, listen to the old podcast. It's not putting it on the streets or putting it in the pubs. It's getting going to chemists and things like that. Or with the case of opium, it's heroin clinics, which have started opening up in this country anyway, because the problem so bad. And you're looking to Keir Starmer, won't even entertain a conversation about it. You're like, oh, Jesus Christ, man, just listen to the arguments. And then when it, the amount of money we've managed to find or print through the pandemic, why couldn't, yeah, but why can't we do that to save the planet? It just seems so insane to me. Yeah. But there you go. Just a final question, because we're coming to the end of our hour. You know, all the way through the book, you've had amazing, amazing adventures. You know, you risk your life a lot during, especially actually more so, I think, with the humans in the drug cartels and the poachers than anything else. You're now a dad. Has that changed the way you view adventures, or are you going to calm down? How has it made you feel being a dad?
Yeah, I mean, Atlas. So my son was born 6 months ago when I was in Dominican Republic. So I was down on this ocean explorer's job. And
could I just say, by the way, you do put the point in the book, you know, your wife's lovely because she let you do it and not be there because you kind of knew you weren't. But that's part and parcel of the job, is you spend a lot of time away from home, isn't it?
That's it. And, you know, my wife is a producer in TV. She gets it. But also, it was a very difficult decision whether we did it or not. And it was kind of like, I've got 3 trips of work, or I miss it and I see Atlas being born and I have a year of no work, which is that's the way that I operate on, you know, I'm boom or bust with work. And so it was, you know, we got to the point of saying, okay, well, we're going to be home a lot after that. So let's do it. So I was free diving in the morning, sort of thing with humpback whales, doing a filming piece there, and then watched Atlas being born on WhatsApp call that afternoon, which was utterly mind-blowing. And that was the last time that I can remember that I cried. I was just sort of like overjoyed by seeing him being born. I haven't felt like I'm taking more or less risks based on it. I think time will tell with that, but I always feel like I'd rather be the dad that comes home with a story and says, this is what I've been doing and this is what I've learned, this is happening in this part of the world, and do you know what language they speak here, da, 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 then be, you know, I suppose what my other options would be was not to have the stories. And, you know, there's a big sacrifice there, but it's the life that I've always led. It's, you know part of it, you know, is you know, it's the way that I am. And I try to explain that in the book about, you know, that's me and that's the DNA of me. That makes me me, and that will make him him, I think.
Yeah. And I think the big lesson you say in the book, though, which is really important, is you're prepared and you're not taking unnecessary risks. And I think it comes across a lot in that you're not gung ho. You're going, I know the risks here, and I'm always equating it and value, you know, making the calculations to make sure it's safe for everyone. Cause you've got a lot of people's lives, especially when you're doing the TV shows at risk there. Although it's been fantastic talking to you. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. And I reckon I could talk to you for another hour, but I'm trying to keep these at an hour because I think they've worked. Lessons from the Edge, Inspirational Tales of Surviving, Thriving and Extreme Adventure by Auddo Cain is available now. I think it's a great book, well worth the read. Thanks, Auddo.
Tim, thank you so much. Cheers.